Father, thank you so much for this morning, this time we can be together to look into your word, to hear deeper teaching, Father. I just pray that you just be with John and help him to convey to us the deep meanings of your word. God, thank you for all of us being here this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Okay, great. You guys were enjoying the muffins and coffee too much?
But
we got you to come in. Okay, great. So we're going to do a class on the book of Genesis. In the beginning. I'm using a few resources. If you want to do some more in-depth study on your own, I've got, let me see. Commentaries, all right? You don't care about what the commentaries are. A couple of commentaries. Thank you, James, for loaning me his commentary. I got well into that yesterday. So, again, Genesis is the introduction to the Bible, but it's also the introduction to God. And Genesis is a perfect introduction. And really, in many ways, Revelation completes what Genesis started. And Revelation is a perfect ending. And they're like bookends. The topic is similar. The themes are similar. We did a class on Revelation, about 3 years ago. Oops. Oh, that's right. Wrong button. Okay. The book of Genesis, creation, fall, judgment. These are the themes. These are the themes of Genesis. Creation, fall, judgment, and salvation. These are the great themes of Genesis. You can see Joseph in Egypt there and Noah on the ark. Now, here's an outline of the whole Bible. All right, the short version. This is not the Reader's Digest condensed version. This is the condensed version of the Reader's Digest condensed version. By the way, I don't know if you know, but only older people know about Reader's Digest, all right? Always condensed versions, right? And they did publish a Reader's Digest condensed version of the Bible, and they took out the part in Revelation that said, if anybody removes any words in this book, they will be condemned. They took that part out. That was a very good idea. Genesis 1, who is God? Genesis 2, who are we? Genesis 3 and 4, the problem, sin. Genesis 5 to Revelation 20, God is solving the problem. Mm-hmm. Revelation, it says Genesis. What? Revelation 21 and 22, note to self, fix that PowerPoint. Revelation 21 and 22, God has fixed the problem. So you can see that Genesis plays a central role in revealing God's plan to us. Not that you can't find it in other places in the Bible, but it's just that it's described so elegantly, so beautifully, and so completely in the book of Genesis. Another way to do it, almost the same thing, Genesis 1, God created the universe, God created the earth, it was very good. Can we see that? Sure. Genesis 2, God created man so that we could have a relationship with him. Genesis 3 and 4, we messed up very badly, destroying that relationship. Genesis 5 through Revelation 20, God's repairing it. Revelation 21 and 22, God has fixed the problem. These are the great themes in Genesis. And arguably, they're the great themes of the Bible, all right? God, a loving creator. The fall of mankind. Sin and separation from God. And then judgment, not our favorite topic, judgment. And then, of course, the main topic is the solution. God is sending the Messiah. In fact, by the time you get to the end of Revelation, not only have you been given the whole outline, but you've been given the introduction, the story of God providing for sin and to reestablish our relationship. That story is well on its way with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. So the solution, God chooses a man of faith. And really, the story of the Old Testament is the story of God's plan to send for salvation. God chooses a man of faith. God chooses a people. He chooses a nation. He gives them a place. He gives them a covenant. He sends them prophets. All of this to prepare to send the Messiah. And again, you can see these being either happening in Genesis, or you can see them prophesied in Genesis. And really, because Genesis is a beautiful, amazing, incredible, spectacular introduction to the Bible, all right, naturally it's an introduction to two things. It's an introduction to God and an introduction to the Bible. Again, you kind of get a sense for what else is coming down the pipe in the Bible, in the book of Genesis. Genesis is primarily about God's character and his purposes to save sinful man. Genesis serves as an amazing introduction to the Bible. Its themes are the Bible's themes. By the time we get to the end of Genesis, we see the plan. We see the plan to save mankind, and we see that plan well on the way. All right? Now, I've got more than one way to outline Genesis. Here's one way to outline Genesis. Genesis chapter 1 through chapter 11, primeval history. What's that word primeval mean? I'm not even sure. I don't know. Sometimes they call it antediluvian or something like that. So it's kind of like prehistory. Because with Abraham, the Bible's entering history. All right, the things before Abraham, exactly where it was, exactly when it happened, we really have very little idea. All right, but with Abraham, we're entering history, essentially. Now, one mistake that we can make, and I might make it myself, if so, I'll apologize ahead of time, is from a Jewish perspective, chapter 1 through 11 is just the introduction. From the Jewish perspective, really, it all starts with Abraham. And so the story of Genesis probably can be seen more as the story of the patriarchs. That's that second part. So chapter 1 through 11 is, in a sense, an introduction to what's the main thing going on in Revelation is God, Abraham being a man of faith, God choosing Abraham, etc. So most people, when they're teaching Genesis, and maybe me to some extent, but I'm sorry, tend to emphasize the first four chapters by far the most, and then a fair amount in chapter 6-9, and then they kind of breeze through the rest of the book as if, you know, that's a nice little afterthought. But really, I believe from the Jewish perspective, it's about Abraham. The two principal characters in Genesis are God and Abraham. And you have to understand that. You have to understand the role the role of Abraham in God's plan. And I believe other than God, Jesus, Holy Spirit, really Abraham is the principal character in the Old Testament. Even more so than Moses, even more so than David, because Abraham really tells the story, although those others do as well, of course, obviously. All right. Now I'm going to break it down just slightly more, and then I'm going to break it down a lot more. Okay, Genesis 1 and 2, the original state of the world. So basically up to chapter 2, God is making everything, and it's all awesome. All right? And so we in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, we see things as God intended them to be. All right? Nothing bad's happened yet. So there's Genesis 1 and 2. And then there's Genesis 3 through 11, where it goes from bad to worse to worse to even worse. And we see the need for Genesis 12 through 50. So we could divide it up that way. As we see things as they should be, Genesis 1 and 2, Genesis 3 through 11, what the purpose of the rest of the book is, we need to be saved. In Genesis 12 through 50, God initiates the plan to take care of all that stuff. Now, I'm not going to go through the detailed outline because we're just going to go through the book and we're going to do all this. So, creation, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, genealogy. One of the features of Genesis that's worth noting is all these genealogies. Now, you may think those genealogies are boring, but really, the sections of Genesis are broken into you know, up to the first genealogy, up to the second genealogy, up to the third genealogy. And to us, genealogies are boring. As you know, Jews were totally into genealogies, of course. But really, the genealogy is telling us, look, here's the plan. Here's the story. All right, here's how far we've gotten so far. All right, and then we stop again. All right, here's how far the story's progressed. So these genealogies are, from a Jewish perspective, an exciting and amazing, interesting way of telling the story of God's plan of salvation. Now, probably we're not going to spend a lot of time there, but probably you're going to still find them boring. I do to some extent as well. But just understand the place of these genealogies. All right, and then the flood, of course, more genealogies, Tower of Babel, and then Abraham, then Isaac, then Jacob, then Joseph, and then summary, chapter 49, and epilogue, chapter 50. That's pretty much the outline of Genesis. Now, I'm doing a fairly quick introduction. I'm not doing some of this detailed stuff. If you want all that stuff, read a commentary. They'll do a lot of that stuff. But, I mean, I'm going to throw this out there just because you're supposed to. But also, it can even be a bit of a stumbling block. So who wrote Genesis? Well, what's the common opinion?
Moses.
All right, but, you know, and the early church fathers said that, by the way. And they also said that Moses wrote all the first five books and that Joshua kind of assembled it together in its final form. But that's just tradition. I don't think Moses wrote Genesis. Now, I'm sure he wrote parts of Exodus and Leviticus for sure. Deuteronomy, it's a speech by him. He didn't write all of Deuteronomy since it does mention his death and a few things that happen after his death. All right. And I don't know. My perspective is that the book of Genesis seems to be written from the perspective of somebody who lived in Mesopotamia, is thoroughly immersed in Mesopotamian culture and religion and history. The book of Genesis is barely aware of Egypt. I mean, Abraham does go down to Egypt. But the bottom line is, I don't know who wrote Genesis. All that matters to me is that it's inspired by God. But I'm convinced that large parts of it were written long before Moses was born. Now, if you look at Genesis, you see signs of some sort of an editor. That editor may have worked well past the time of Moses. And again, read all these scholars. They have all their speculations about this. You know, in the end, it doesn't really matter. Does it really matter who wrote it? But I think if we understand that the author is an expert in Mesopotamian religion, culture, and history, which it's somewhat unlikely Moses was, I think it might give you a little bit of perspective on what you're going to find in the book. Take it for what it's worth. The bottom line is we do not know who wrote Genesis. And by the way, if you read all the experts, they'll talk about these four different sources: the Jehovah's source, the priestly source, the Elohist source, and the Deuteronomical source. I take that with a big grain of salt.
Question for you, John.
Yeah.
Where it says speculative and unlikely, are you saying those?
All right. So since you ask, a lot of skeptics and critics of the Bible, see, so many of these people don't even believe in God and believe in the Bible, all right? And if you read and study the Bible through a lens that's flat out wrong, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. But, for example, they'll notice that, for example, Genesis, the first creation account, God is called Elohim. And in the second creation account, he's called El. And they'll say, well, that's two different authors. You know what? I personally believe there were two different authors of the two different creation accounts. But these people want to say that somebody sort of took two or three different flood accounts and sort of patched them all together and made some obvious mistakes and these kinds of things. And I don't believe that. There were almost certainly multiple sources used to put Genesis into its final form. These people, it's so blatant speculation to me that basically they're saying there were a bunch of people who came from a priestly perspective who wrote their own document, and these people don't agree with these people, and all this kind of stuff. Yeah.
So when you're saying those authors there, that biblical criticism is saying people who are looking at it.
Not just different authors, completely different perspectives, who radically disagree with each other, who's the result of whose argument that they never worked it out produced this book, which has no central theme. I mean, this is what the skeptics say. And I don't believe it at all. In fact, I believe that it doesn't even make sense. I mean, in that Genesis is its organization, its theme, its ideas are coordinated, and it's an amazing outline. All right, so almost certainly to me, somebody put it in its final form using a number of different sources, even different accounts. Don't know. Doesn't matter to me. It's worth thinking about, especially because you're going to read stuff by skeptics who don't believe in God, and they're going to try to get you to think that, you know, whoever did it, they didn't have any agreement, theologic differences and all that stuff. All right, great. So like I said, I want to do a quick introduction. I want to get right into the book of Genesis. So let's do that. All right. Now, as we get into Genesis 1, we need to understand what Genesis 1 is. It's a story about God. Genesis 1 is theology. Really, Genesis 1 through 4 is primarily theology. If you want to read these as history, you're making a fairly big mistake. Is there historical content in these creation accounts? Well, I believe so. There are sincere believers who would say no, that these are merely literary devices with no historical material at all. I happen to disagree with that fairly strongly. I have friends who take that perspective. But it's certainly not principally history. It wasn't intended as history. And those who read it didn't think of it as history. I'm sure about that. So it's introduction to God, and it's primarily thematic. And yet I believe there is historical content there, in the sense that first the universe was created, and then the earth was created, and God created order out of chaos, and then God created life, and God created humans, and God created humans in his image, and those humans fell, and these kinds of things. I don't believe these are mere fables, essentially, that tell a proper theological story. You understand, the people who say this, they're believers. They believe in the inspiration of the Bible, but they just believe that these are stories just intended to give us a message, that there is little, if any, historical content. I don't agree with that, for what it's worth. But I just want to show you how amazing. Let's just start by reading and see how amazing and deep the theology in Genesis is. By the time you finish reading Genesis 1, 1 and 2, every other ism has already been dealt with. For example, it says, in the beginning. So what's that mean? It means there was a beginning. Well, right away, the religion of Mesopotamia is refuted. All right? And Hinduism, refuted. Buddhism, refuted. Because all of these worldviews conceive of the universe as eternal. The Bible, the very beginning, says it was created. Okay? Now, of course, there's two possibilities on that. That's either true, or it's not true. Well, guess what? It's true. And those other isms are false. All right, that's pretty simple stuff. Every religion comes with a cosmology. Okay? Then, in the beginning, God. So what's that tell us? That God pre-existed. Okay, that's not the Babylonian view. The Babylonian view is the world existed and Marduk came along and kind of did all this stuff in their creation myth. All right, and again, pantheism is destroyed by this idea. dualism, another philosophy, very common philosophy in the first centuries. Not true. Atheism clearly ruled out. All right? Animism, the idea that spirit pervades the universe. Polytheism, in the beginning, gods. Okay? So, I mean, how many words are we into the Bible? Three, I think, actually. I think it's three, technically, whatever. But, you know, hey, yeah. All right? And we've already dispensed with all the other worldviews. Now, that's assuming it's true, obviously. So you have to understand the purpose, especially of Genesis 1, is to annihilate all other worldviews. It's not to give a detailed scientific outline of, you know, the steps and order of the creation. Although I still believe, despite all that, that there is history here. So in the beginning God. Oh, and then in the beginning God created. Now, let me see if I have another. Yeah, there's this this fancy word, enuma elish. Probably, how many of you have heard of the Gilgamesh epic? All right, yeah, about half of you. That's the flood account. That's the Babylonian flood account. More famous to us, more well-known to us. But the Babylonian creation account is called the Enuma Elish. Okay? And one way of thinking of Genesis 1 is the writer here is reading the Babylonian creation account and point by point refuting what's in the Babylonian creation account. So he's not necessarily going against Indian pantheism necessarily, although it is limited. He's not necessarily opposing dualism per se, or atheism, although all of those are refuted. If you want to understand kind of the point, some of the stuff he's saying, he's specifically gearing this towards the beliefs of the people in Mesopotamia and in Egypt as well at that time. So again, the message applies to them specifically and then to us generally. So the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation myth. So when he says, in the beginning God created, he's doing this this polemic. Oh, there's a big word, polemic. I don't know. When I use fancy words, I probably need to define them. Okay, a polemic is basically an argument geared to attack or destroy another position. So when you're doing a polemic, you're not having a discussion. When you're doing a polemic, you are attacking. Yeah, you're attacking another position. You're not trying to create a balanced discussion here. And Genesis 1, really Genesis 1 through 11, are a polemic, all right, against the... I looked it up in the dictionary. Actually, nobody looks it up in the dictionary anymore. We all look it up in Google, right? Yeah. A polemic is a strong verbal or written attack on someone or something. And the first 11 books of Genesis are that. They're not a discussion. They're an attack. And I believe one done in love, I guess. Maybe not love of the people listening, maybe not love of that religion. All right. So in the beginning, God created. And according to Enuma Elish, the gods coexist with the universe. And the creation was a reworking of existing material. All Near Eastern and Eastern religions agree on this. They're all wrong on this, but they all agree on this. Okay? Hebrews 11:3, it says, by faith we know that what is seen was created from things that are unseen. Right? Hebrews 11:3. By faith we know all the visible things were created by things that are not visible. And that thing is God. God pre-existed the universe. By the way, the word created here in Hebrew is a little bit ambiguous. All right? In other words, in principle, that word could mean to create out of existing material or to create out of nothing. In principle. All right? But when you go to Hebrews 11:3, it makes the meaning clear. In fact, by the time you finish reading Genesis chapter 1, it's also clear this is creation out of nothing. The fancy terminology is ex nihilo. People want to make you think they're smart, will say creation ex nihilo, out of nothing. That's just Latin for out of nothing. So why not just say creation out of nothing? That seems like a little bit better way to communicate with actual real people, all right? So we'll go for that. So in the beginning, in the beginning, God created. And it says, God created the heavens and the earth. And so what that means, he created everything out there. Because from the ancient mindset, there's here and there's everything else. So he created here and he created everything else. And I believe by implication, he created the, you know, heaven as in the spiritual realms as well. Because God is the creator of the physical realm and the spiritual realm. So Genesis 1 is a polemic against the Babylonian creation myth. This is a quote from one of the commentaries I read. This guy went and he said, Genesis 1 through 11 is a commentary often highly critical on ideas current in the ancient world about both the natural and the supernatural world. In the Babylonian creation account, human beings are an afterthought. In the Babylonian creation accounts, the human beings were created to serve the gods. But in the Genesis creation account, we are the focus and the purpose of creation. Creation is about us. It's not about God. It's not about the gods. But in the Genesis creation account, the creation itself is about us. We are the culmination of it, and we are the purpose of it. So again, we see the writer of Genesis clearly denouncing the worldview. I've got a fairly extended set of notes here about worldview. I think I want to spend about only 3 or 4 minutes on this, so I want to get back into Genesis. Worldview is the perspective used to process and interpret information about the world. There are a number of different worldviews. These are the common ones. All right, naturalism, atheism, postmodernism, which says there's no legitimate worldview, deism, which says God creates, but he doesn't involve himself. Pantheism, which says God and the universe are co-equal and coextensive, and you know, you are God, everything is God, you know, that kind of thing. Animism, polytheism, dualism, and then biblical theism. By the time you get to the end of Genesis 1:1, the only two that are left are deism and biblical theism. Then when you get to Genesis 2, deism is gone because God is involving himself very intimately in the created world. And really, in Acts 17, where Paul is saying, you guys don't know what you're talking about, he's kind of having the same discussion in Athens with the philosophers that the writer of Genesis is having with the ancient world. All right, so now I want to describe the way I see the biblical worldview. And this would be a good exercise. In fact, let me leave that slide. Oh, you're just before she took a picture. This is going to be posted on my website. Plus, I'll put it back up there. I saw her about to hit the button right as I pushed my button. So, oh, sorry. All right. This would be a good exercise is, what is the biblical view of reality? I'm going to take away your ability to do that exercise by answering the question for myself. But that would be a worthwhile thought is, again, how would you explain, without using the Bible necessarily, how would you describe how the Bible presents the nature of just reality itself? And I believe by the time you get to the end of chapter 3 of Genesis, the entire Christian worldview is clearly laid out, crystal clear. In fact, as clearly as it's laid out anywhere in the Bible. Again, establishing my point, which is this is theology. Okay? So the Christian worldview, as I see it, using Genesis 1 through 4, the physical world is real. Hinduism says it's not. It uses the word Maya, illusion. All right? It's real. It's created out of nothing, ex nihilo, and it's good. Dualism says it's bad. Physical stuff is bad. The Greek mindset, and in some ways the ancient mindset, was physical stuff is bad. The spiritual things are good, the physical things are bad. But according to the Bible, the entire creation is good, right? How good? Verse 31, Very good. We'll see that. There exists an unseen spirituality, which is not defined by the physical, and humans are both physical and spiritual. So the biblical worldview is there's physical things, there's spiritual things. They kind of sort of coexist in reality, and that we human beings are both physical and spiritual. Number three, the creator of all these things is the God who reveals himself in the Bible, specifically the God who's revealed in Genesis chapter 1. All right, we are therefore both physical and spiritual. Number five, God, the creator of all, can be characterized by a few qualities. He is a person. He is love. He is just. He is holy. He's omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent. These are the qualities of that God. Number six, although creation is good, evil exists. That's one of the central problems. And really, as human beings created religions, you could argue religions were created to solve this problem. What is the nature of creation, and why is there evil in the world? The Bible makes a seemingly contradictory set of statements, which is, number one, everything is good, and yet evil exists. And different worldviews have different solutions to this problem. Hinduism and Buddhism say because evil's not real. Well, that really solves the problem. Also, atheism says evil? What do you mean evil? There's just stuff. The evil is a meaningless word. Okay? But the Bible has an answer for this. Whether it's right or wrong is for us to decide. I think we've already come down on the side of the Bible, so I'm just describing what you already hopefully know. Although creation is good, evil exists. Evil exists because of freedom. Everything God created obeys him. Everything he created obeys him. Except us. And some of the angels, apparently. We don't know much about that. But apparently, at least one of the angels had already rebelled against God before we were even created. We're going to see some room for that between Genesis 1:2 and Genesis 1:3. Did you know that probably there was a lot of time before Genesis 1:3, for what it's worth? Anyway, so the reason evil exists is because God loved us. That's why. Because God loved his creatures, he gave them a choice. And love gives a choice. You can't force somebody to love us. And really, that's what Genesis 2 is about, right? It's about that we were created to have an intimate fellowship and shared love with God. But that could only be based on choice. All right? And so the Bible, the Christian worldview, is an explanation of evil. And it is clearly laid out right there in Genesis 1, 2, and 3. Because of God's justice and his holiness, those are those qualities on point 5, those who rebel will be separated, judged, and separated for eternity. And the last one, the most encouraging part, is God created a solution to all this in sending his son as a sacrifice. And again, all of this is in the first four chapters of Genesis. Okay? A good worldview is one that's true, that answers the important questions, and that works. All right? And again, if I had time, I'd do a worldview treatment and I'd talk about why the Christian worldview is the only one. But I would say the Christian worldview is true. Number one, it is true that the universe is created out of nothing. It is true that creation is good. It is true that there's a physical and a spiritual reality. Those are things that, in my opinion, are undeniable truths. Some of the other truths, such as God will judge, you know, I suppose we could say that's not completely self-evident. But I would say if we were to list all other worldviews and just go down the list, they say this is true, this is true, this is this true. If Genesis 1 is right, and it is, I mean, reality tells us that it is, then the Christian worldview is the only true one. Also, I believe a good worldview answers the questions that people really care about, such as, what is the purpose and meaning of life? What is our value? What is our place in the universe? What is the right thing to do? Why is there evil? Why is there suffering? And again, I believe these are answered in Genesis, although I don't have time to go into that in detail. And also, I believe that Christianity is the worldview that just common sense, just application of common sense, creates the best kind of person. Because we have responsibility. We have dignity. We have choice. These are things that other worldviews do not assign to human beings. By the way, I believe they also just happen to be true. But I'm getting a little bit away from Genesis, so let's get back into the book of Genesis. Right, we're going to take a break in about 10 minutes or so, about halfway through. So that coffee you left out there might get a little cold by now, but you can finish it up. And, okay, oh, several pages. Wow, run through all these pages. Great. Well, we've gotten through Genesis 1, verse 1. That's pretty good. Making some progress. Now we're in Genesis 1, verse 2. Really, we've done the first two verses. Let me read those again. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. So God created the universe, but now it's going to give it form and shape and definition. And by the way, it just so happens that, according to physicists, this is exactly correct. The universe was created out of nothing, and it was just a bunch of atoms dispersed almost exactly equally throughout the universe. And then over time, order was created out of chaos. And so, although, again, this is not a scientific treatise, the broad outline of what's being said here does describe what actually happened. So God is creating order out of disorder, and he's creating distinctions. In other words, things were indistinct. It was kind of gray. So what was gray, God is making black and white. What was undefined, God is defining. So God separates light from dark. You know, sky or firmament from land. He separates the living from the non-living. And he separates male from female. And I appreciate how Brandon really put that out there. Those of you who were there last weekend, the way he described it, I thought that was really beautiful. And he also separates good from evil. And by the way, the concept of separation is also the concept of holiness. And so the story here is God is creating holiness. He makes differences and distinctions. That's a theme here. Again, if it's true scientifically as well, and I believe it is, it's maybe somewhat accidentally also true scientifically. God creates nothing out of nothing. This is essentially what God does in outline form in Genesis 1. He creates something out of nothing. He creates order out of chaos. He creates distinctions out of things that were separate, and he names things. If you look through there, it says in verse 5, it says, let's read verse 3. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. God saw the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. He called the light day, and he called the darkness night. And there was evening, and there was morning the first day. All right, so God is separating light from darkness, but he's also naming it. And from the ancient Near Eastern perspective, to name something means to have dominance over that thing. Right? And notice in Genesis 1, who's doing the naming? God. In Genesis 2, who's doing the naming? We are. And that's an illustration of the fact that we're created in God's image. The fact that we name things, that's one of the ways we are like God. All right? Because He gave us authority and power over this world. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. That's one of the themes of Genesis 1, is that basically God said, here's the earth, it's yours, essentially. He created it, and he didn't totally step aside, right? Definitely not. All right? And so God is naming things, and for us, okay, it's nice, you know, I name my dog Fido, I name my town, my street. No. The action of naming something is huge in ancient cultures. All right? Like they would say in the Middle Ages, halt in the name of the king. Because his name is Bill? No. By the authority of, right? Yes, question, comment?
Can you talk more about the language that was used in the naming part?
We don't really know. I mean, clearly the language that God was using? Oh, he's not using words. God does not have a mouth. He does not have a lip and tongues and a tongue and teeth. He does not form words. He could if he wanted to for our sake. So this action of speaking, this is we're talking about anthropomorphizing, right? To anthropomorphize is to give a human quality to something that's clearly not human. So God, you know, Dave says, God hand reached. God doesn't have a hand. He doesn't have arms. And when he speaks, this is a philosophical, let's say, a metaphysical speech. All right? Yes. Again, the original language of Genesis probably was Hebrew. Probably some of the sources were not Hebrew. They might have been, I don't know, Akkadian language or Babylonian language, Sumerian language. But that's not what you're asking, right? Yeah, God can speak in any language that he wants, but I'm sure when he's speaking, he's not using language. All right? In the beginning was the Word, right? What's that mean? Does that mean the word house or, you know, the Word? That word has a philosophical or a metaphysical meaning to it. Okay? In fact, the word implies creation. All right? A creative power. So God speaks and it happens. Is he speaking with a tongue and lips and air coming out of his lungs? Of course not. And obviously you know that as well. You know that, obviously. That's a good question, though. That's a very good question. All right, great. So a couple other kind of interesting things here. All right? It says this. And it says the Spirit was hovering, right? Where is that? Verse 2. Yes. God said, I'm sorry, verse 2. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. So what's that mean? Is that talking about the Holy Spirit? Maybe. Commentators seem to be pretty much unanimous that this is not sort of an introduction to the Trinity. I mean, it could be. I don't know. I believe when it says God's Spirit is hovering over the waters, it means God is hovering over the waters. And he's not like hovering, you know, like that. He's sort of eminent there. And he's kind of present. Thank you. He's present. So are we being introduced to the Holy Spirit here? Put it this way, if so, I would not use that as a proof text. So that was your thought when I asked that question. I'm not saying that thought is wrong. I've certainly heard it before. I'm not going to say it's wrong. I'm just going to say, maybe. But please don't use that verse to prove that the Holy Spirit is there in Genesis 1, because I think that's not a very convincing proof, for what it's worth. Another thing, there's a lot of pattern here. The commentators go on and on, drone on and on and on about the fact that, you know, there's the statement and the creation and it's good. And all. There's this formula that all these days have a formula. You can read it for yourself. You can write it down. I'm not going to spend a lot of time there. But it's interesting. He says there was evening and there was morning the first day. That's not what we would say. What would we say? We'd say there was morning and there was evening the first day. So why does he say there's evening and morning the first day? Because he's Jewish, right? And when does this day start, Philip, to a Jewish person? at sunset. So when it's kind of interesting, he says there's evening, there's morning, the first day. But the reason is because that's when the day starts. So for us, the day starts when the sun comes up, but not to the Jews. All right. Now, I'm going to talk about the framework theory. I'm going to talk about the first 3 days versus the second 3 days, the kind of things happening the first 3 days versus the kind of things happening the second 3 days. But I'm going to do that a little bit later. How am I doing? All right. I've been going for about 45 minutes. So let's take a, I'll call it a 5-minute break, but you know it's probably going to be a little bit more than 5 minutes. All right, so we're going to take a break.
Five minutes.
Officially a 5-minute break. If you didn't register, please go back and register with Jan. You could buy a couple of books while you're out there, get a cup of coffee, get a muffin. How am I doing? Yeah.
Are you going to be able
yeah.
to? Oh, so if I miss a couple of classes in the next 6 weeks.
Yeah, it'll all be recorded. Okay. The notes will be up. The outline will be up. Everything will be there. No problem at all. You bet. Am I on slide 23 already? Wow.
How many more do you have to go?
I love it.
Wow. That's a lot of slides.
I was thoughts of caveman was coming into my mind, you know, like how they
I'll talk a little bit about that. I'll talk a little bit about that.
So
yeah. All right, one more muffin. That'll be my breakfast.
Just one.
I'll see you. If there aren't many, I may not have a fish.
It'll only keep it like, you know, one
thing. Yeah, say hi to her for me.
Delicious, Mom.
How's it going?
Good, brother.
Okay. Yeah, we needed a break. Yeah. No doubt. Yes, they're the same kind, yes. Uh-oh. My thing didn't. Sorry. Yep, just one kind.
I feel like I'm always tired and I never catch up.
Are you waiting for the green juice too?
Yeah, I think so. The best.
Thanks for doing the class. I think it's good.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure. Believe me.
Yeah, same thing for setting up the conference and everything. It's really good. I know a lot of people, we were talking afterwards, it's like really cool. Everyone's like, oh, it's a big conference and everything. Yeah.
Cool. So what's happening with you?
Well, we got UCSD from the, just finished our rec week. We've been running out doing tables and all sorts of stuff like that.
Yeah, you guys start so late. It's kind of crazy.
Crazy week, but it's been fun. We have our Friday Devo events. We just did like a scavenger hunt across UCSD. It was really fun because like what it is, it's kind of like a scavenger hunt. It's like dares. There's like a list of like stuff you have to do, and you have to like take a picture, like a video of like your team doing it. And each dare, depending on how big of a dare it is, it's like worth more points. Every team has the most points by the end of the hour, like wins the prize.
What are some of the crazy things that people did?
Fun stuff.
What are some of the crazy
things? One's like you have to find like a group of people and like start singing like All Star, you know that song? Like the song All Star by Smash Mouth. Like the track. You've seen Shrek even the song. We have to like find, it's basically like, you know, find a group of people and like start just like take a video of like someone just like running up and like singing the song. There's like a Triton statue, there's like a Triton statue you should see, you got Kiss the Statue. Like, right, it's just like, get a video of like someone coming out of an elevator, like, it's like different things like that. So.
Cool.
Fun
stuff. Sounds like fun. You ever done a road rally? It's a little bit like that.
What's that word?
Well, 13 of y'all in a car. Mm-hmm. You have clues. You have to drive around to different places based on these obscure clues.
Okay.
And when you get there, it gives you the next clue. So you see people driving around that are also in the road rally, like they're going the other way, you're going that way, it's like
so is it like a race?
It's a race, yeah. But you're supposed to stay within the speed limit. I'm sure people don't though.
Yeah.
Cool. Let me know if there's a book you want. Just got a few out here. These are my books here.
I really enjoyed the seminar a couple of weeks ago.
Good.
That was amazing.
Great. Wow, you're here two weekends in a row. It's been a busy last couple of weeks for Jen and I, between the two of them.
I was also at the North County on Wednesday night.
Midweek, yeah.
Yeah, midweek that you did.
Good. Well, you must be getting tired of seeing me speak by now, three times
really
in a week.
Inspiring. I'm a new Christian, so apparently.
Great. Yeah, there's another woman here. She uses the crutches. I don't know her name.
Oh. Yes.
She told me her name. Yeah, she's here. Good. We haven't had that many come from the north before. That's good to see. So did we hit 50? I think we did.
Yeah, I think. Oh, we all did. 59.
Well, but some didn't show up. So.
Yeah.
Oh, there's some.
I'm not too much of a history guy. So, Chris Chan, I think he's on
Chang. Chris Chang.
Did he write his name? Right there, Chris
Chang. Right here.
He said he played on the app, but I have a Carolyn. This Carolyn must be his wife.
Probably.
Great.
Okay, Taskmaster says time to go back in. Please.
John.
Yeah.
What it is, I just
John. Yeah.
Hey, as Jesus, God did have a mouth and everything else.
Well, there you go. In Jesus, that's a good point. All right. Are we ready to start again? It's been 7 minutes. So I'm going to start the tape. Yep. Thanks.
You can hit it later.
No, I stopped the tape. I'm going to just restart it here. It's one nice thing to sing you. hit it and it stops it, then you hit it again and it ends it. So I'm going to hit it. No, I'm going to hit it. And it's now recording again. Yes. I think so anyway. Okay, so we're going to start while people are filtering in here. Thank you very much. Now, I'm going to come back around and kind of say, talk about what happened on the first day, and what happened on the second day, and what happened on the third day. I'm going to do a little bit of that. Again, I'm not sure if the order is terrifically significant to the writer, as much as what God did and how he did it. All right? So you might be thinking, oh, no, wait a minute, let's do the second day. No, wait, let's do the third day. I'm purposely not going to go through it right now in that sense. I'm trying to get the bigger picture here. We'll come back and look at it in a little bit more detail. All right? But basically, one way of thinking about it is the first 3 days, God is creating the place in which life can exist, and then the next 3 days, God is creating the life to exist in that place. It's not as simple as that. People who try to get a definite organization, to some extent, the first chapter of Genesis defies like super precise organization of the information. There's things you can say in general. But in verse 11 through 25, God is creating life. And talk about creating order out of disorder. Because the physical laws that God created, one of those being gravity, causes planets and stars and galaxies to form, and even causes oceans to form. And the other physical laws that God created would even cause water to be separated from land over time. But the one thing that would not happen, according to any physical law that God created, is the creation of life itself. So to some extent, the laws that God created kind of naturally created a certain amount of order and separation between light and dark, land and water, sky and earth. But this final amount of order God created would have never come about by any random event. Molecules bumping into each other, next thing you know, life. And so that's the ultimate level of order. Or in physics, the ultimate reduction in entropy, if you will. All right, and that it's interesting, it's the fourth day, I believe, right? Verse 14, let's read verse 14 here. And God said, let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night. Now I'm going to talk about how there could have been day and night before the stars appeared in the sky. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. And it may or may not be the correct answer, but it's just a thought. But what do we normally call those objects? The sun and the moon. Why doesn't he call them the sun and the moon? Again, you have to understand what he's doing. He's creating a polemic, an argument about the basic assumptions about the world, of the ancient world. And so, because the word sun was the name of a god. And the word moon was the name of a god. So he's not even, and the language is awkward. In any language, what he's saying is awkward. All right? And I'm sure those who, in the immediate time who read what the writer wrote here thought that's kind of a weird way to say it. Why not just say the sun and the moon? But the point is he's trying to demythologize. That's why I talk about a big fancy thing here. He's trying to take the idea of these objects having influence over us or having supernatural powers. All they are is just servants. The only reason they exist is so we would have darkness to sleep at night and light to be able to light awake during the day. So these greater light, the sun, lesser light, the moon, this is, again, it's a polemic against the Mesopotamian worship of heavenly objects. It's demythologizing, de-supernaturalizing that which is purely natural. All right? And the ancients viewed, you know, the whole idea of astrology and astronomy being, you know, astrology and astronomy were the same thing to them. For us, astrology is nonsense. Hopefully it is. I was listening to a student saying, yeah, man, I'm a Sagittarius. Just Thursday. I'm a Sagittarius. Yeah, that's what... It's like, do that. I mean, seriously. You believe this stuff?
Yeah, the earth is
full. Oh, my goodness. So the Genesis writer simply calls them lights. The greater light and the lesser light. They are mere surrogates. They're merely performing the role for which God created them, but we are much greater than they are. Size is not relevant to importance, is it? Okay? Some people would say, how could you think that human beings are even paid attention to by God? The earth is so small compared to the universe. Since when did size have anything to do with it? Right? Good things come in small packages.
Yeah.
That's us. So these lights are there to serve God, in other words, to obey Him, and to serve man. And it has the role of creating light and dark, day and night, and also seasons. It also helps us to know and understand the seasons. I'm skipping here because I'm going to come back and talk about the individual days, trying to get the big picture. I want to skip down to all the way down to verse 26 here. It's not that the specifics aren't important, but I want to get the big picture. All right, verse 26. So now life has been produced in the air, on the land, in the water, and the sea creatures have been created, and cattle. All right, and then, but the ultimate apex, the goal towards which it all was looking is about to happen. God is about to create mankind. And by the way, the word Adam means mankind. Okay? Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in His own image. In the image of God, He created them. Male and female, He created them. Again, He's creating distinction and difference here. God blessed them, and He said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves along the ground. All right, and then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit in it, seed in it. They'll be yours for food to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground. Everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food, and it was so. All right, so it says here, God created us in His image and in His likeness. And the Hebrew word for image is like, you know, an image, like an idol or a statue or something like that. So, of course, they didn't have the idea of a picture, like a photograph. But if they had photographs, this would be the word they'd use for that. He created us in His image and in His likeness. Now, the scholars have a heyday with the difference between image and likeness. I'm not sure if there is a distinction here. It could be he's just repeating himself for emphasis. I actually don't know. But the idea of being created in His image means to appear like Him. And then in His likeness means to be like Him, which is not exactly the same. His image to essentially, the normal meaning of that is to appear like Him. And then he's kind of like explaining. In other words, to be like him. So not that we look like him. Not that he's bipedal. Or not that he has hair. But we're in his image in that we're like him. Okay? So let's open this up for discussion. In what sense do you think we are in the image of God? Right. By what attributes are we in the image of God? Yeah.
Our emotions.
Okay, yeah, we have emotions. Now, do dogs and cats have emotions?
Yeah.
Yes. Do we have a different set of emotions, a higher set of emotions? I think so. So, yes. So I agree with that.
We're spiritual beings.
All right. We are not merely physical. We're also spiritual. We have a soul. Now, there's a problem. Nephesh is the Hebrew word for soul, and it creates problems for us because the word nephesh means soul, and it means a soul. And that's a problem, all right? And so, because it says every living soul, and then we have a soul, so that creates problems. But I know what you mean by we have a soul, and I believe Genesis makes that distinction, but the language is a little bit difficult. But anyway, so we have emotions, and let's just say we have the same emotions that God has, to be more specific, because cats and dogs have emotions, and we have a soul. We have a spiritual nature. What other ways are we like God? Right. We are creators. We create. I mean, now we create out of existing things, physically, but ideas are not existing things. We create things. In some sense, we rearrange things in creating, but in other ways, we create brand new things. Out of nothing, not physically, but in an idea-wise. So, yes, we are creators. And it's pretty awesome being a creator. It's one of the just amazing things about us. Yes, Jan and then Lauren. Jan wants Lauren to go first. All right.
We have a conscience.
Right. Actually, there's two words that sound almost exactly the same. Conscience. And conscious, right? We have conscience, and we are conscious. Now, in other words, we have a sense of right and wrong. We have an inherent knowledge of right and wrong. Now, do dogs have a conscience?
No.
They look like it, right? They kind of go, oh, you know, they do something bad. But no, they don't have a conscience. All right? They might have a very, very, very weak version of a conscience, sort of, I guess. All right, but conscious means self-aware. And that's one thing that separates us from the other animals. A lot of us, you know, over time, animals, through science we discovered animals have more things than we thought they did, you know. And so the naturalists want to tell us we're just another animal. All right, but Genesis tells us we're definitely not just another animal. And, you know, dogs, I guess, have emotions in a very, 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 very weak sort. But I don't think dogs are self-aware. I'm pretty sure they're not. So we have a conscience. In that sense, we're in the image of God, knowledge of good and evil. And we're conscious. Yes?
We get to choose.
Right. We have free will. It's another way we're different. Another way we're different is that we are persons. And being a person kind of goes along with being conscious or self-aware. We are individual persons with personality. Do dogs have personality? Yes. Are they persons? No. Do all dogs go to heaven? I don't think so.
Some
do.
Yeah, some do.
All I know is whatever's in heaven is a lot better than your dog, all right?
Right.
So that's good enough to me, okay? Okay. Yeah. Right.
When he creates man, he said, let us
That's the next slide. I'm going to talk about that. We're getting there. I want to finish the thought of being made in God's image, and then we'll talk to us. Yes?
How about the sense of wanting to help or save others?
Good. So a moral sense in this conscience, and I think that's part of our conscience, which is the desire to help. And also, how about the ability to love, the ability to give and receive love? Can dogs give and receive love? Well, kind of. Kind of. All right. Kind of. Another thing is, and this is one of the chief things, I believe you could argue this is one of the chief things that makes us in the image of God in Genesis 1, is that we are rulers. We are kings and queens. Over our own conscience, over our own decisions, but also over the physical world. I mean, that in the context, that's what he's talking about. He created us in his image, and then he talks about, and therefore we're in charge. So we are rulers. And I could continue my joke, are dogs rulers? Well, in some houses, yes, they are.
Yeah, they are.
But that I'm extending the joke too far. I need to leave that joke. Go on to a different joke. But we are created in God's image. It does not mean that God has toes. God does not have genitalia. God is not male. And some people get all upset that the NIV takes that gender stuff out. But, you know, come on, that's just language. That's the Greek language. It's like the Spanish language. The Spanish language uses the male endings for both. So, come on, guys, stop it. It's only men who have that problem, not women. So just think about that, guys. But God is not a man. And he's our father. He's also our mother. Although the Bible doesn't confuse us by throwing those out there all the time. But God is not, he's not in our image in that he's either male or female. Because if he was either male or female, then one of us wouldn't be created in his image in that sense. Okay, we are rulers. Next, verse 23, why plural? All right, and the commentators have a number of explanations. I don't know the answer, okay? And there they are, by the way, they're up on the screen. The royal we. Often the king says we. The king, that's the royal we. So the president says we, and he means me. Because me speaks for we, and therefore we say we. So that's one explanation. It's in quotes, the royal we. The plural of majesty is another way of saying it, the plural of majesty. Another explanation, the one that's believed by the commentator in this one, is that God, at this point, the angels are already there. In fact, we know that the angels are already there by implication. It's not stated in Genesis 1, but it's certainly implied in Genesis 2. Because what's that serpent doing there? When was that serpent created? We don't know. We don't need to know. So therefore, God didn't tell us. So we could mean God and those others in attendance in this sort of scene, if you will. Another possibility. Or it could mean, hey, me, my son, and my spirit. So again, my suggestion, don't use this as a proof text for the Trinity, because it's not a very good proof text. Is this evidence of the plurality of persons of God? I would say maybe. In fact, I'd go so far as to say probably, and say I even slightly disagree with this author. But for what it's worth, I don't know. So why he switches to using we at this point, I believe it's specifically because mankind is being created. And so either we have witnesses or, you know, God who's creating us in order to have a relationship with us is speaking in his relational way with his relational self. And that whole triune thing, that's kind of confusing, but that's the way the Bible describes it, right? All right, then verse 28. It says God blessed them. God blessed them. That's why He created us. He created us because He wanted to love us. And He wanted us to love Him. And when you love somebody, you bless them. And what was the one form that blessing took? He says, be fruitful and multiply. This is the only commandment in the Bible that human beings have ever actually fully obeyed. We've done a pretty darn good job. God is probably satisfied with our obedience to being fruitful and filling the earth. But it is the nature of His creation to multiply. But the idea of blessing is here. And we're about to see that. We're about to see the garden. We're going to head into the garden in a few minutes here. And then this is a blessing. So God didn't create you to work. He created you to bless you. But one of the blessings, of course, is to work and to create. But, you know, understand, it's not like a taskmaster. He wants us to work because He knows we're happy when we're working. We're joyful when we're working. But it's not like, you know, the Babylonians' idea, which is the people were there to work for the gods. No, God is there to work for us. And we parents totally get it. I was talking to Jeremy this morning. I said, yeah, you're going to kind of get pretty busy pretty time. Jeremy Melchior Post is going to be a dad within about a month. And there's a lot of work involved. Yes? Lauren?
Yeah, I mean, what do you say to people that kind of look at blessing as the end all? And that's kind of the goal.
Well, from God's perspective, that's pretty much true. I mean, why you brought some children into the world? Why did you bring children into the world? To make you feel, to fulfill your ego, to give you, you know, why did you bring children into the world?
To love and to be loved.
Yeah, right. So there, I'd say, from the point of view, God's purpose in creating us, that probably is largely true. All right, but our goal and purpose is not to make sure we get as many blessings as possible. That's our part, is to honor and glorify and serve our Creator. So if you're talking about our purpose and goal, no, no. But really, I think if you could kind of turn that argument around on that person a little bit and say, if you're talking about God, I think you're probably right. But if we're talking about the prosperity gospel and all that kind of stuff, because God is well aware that if He just, and you as parents know, right, Sammy, your parents don't give you everything you want, right? No. If they'd given you everything you want, you probably wouldn't have been baptized last weekend. You would have been a selfish brat, as what all of us have been. And the bottom line is God wants to bless us as much as He can without messing us up. All right, and so there's suffering and there's discipline and all those things. Those don't disprove, though, this verse in verse 28, which the goal is for us to be happy. I mean, nothing makes a parent happier than to see their children satisfied and fulfilled in their life and having relationships. So I would say to that person, you're right. Just we need to redefine it a little bit. All right, so another comment? Okay, great. All right, now let's get to this subdue and rule thing. We've already read these verses. I read all the way from 26 through 30. And he repeats himself. It's almost like, why does he keep saying this? All right? He says, "I'm you're in charge here. You're going to rule over these things." I remember there was a Secretary of the Interior back in the 80s. He was from Colorado, and basically he said, you know, we can do with it whatever we want, you know, because God's going to bring it to an end anytime soon. He was a total anti-environmentalist guy. Remember that guy? Who was that? I can't remember his name. No. Way before that. Anyway, so basically God says, hey, you're the head honcho around here. You're king of the earth. And this stuff is all for you. So how does that mean we should treat those things that he put us as rulers over? Stewards, well. All right. So shouldn't Christians naturally be environmentalists? Yes. Does that mean it's that we spend our whole life and all our energy, you know, marching? Maybe for some, you know, for some that might be their thing, all right? That might be their thing. Don't give me that scowl, Rudy. Come on. I think he's maybe really slightly from the conservative end of the spectrum here. That's cool, bro. We love you. All right? But seriously, Hebrews chapter 2, verse 8. Hebrews 2, verse 8. Wanton abuse of the physical creation is a non-Christian thing to do. And I've never seen Rudy wantonly abusing the environment. He's an awesome guy. You recycle, right, Rudy?
Yes.
Amen.
Do.
See, there you go.
We do recycle.
Yes, he recycles. Good for him. Hebrews 2, verse 8. I'll go back to verse 7. You made them a little lower than the angels. You crowned them with glory and honor. He's talking about us. By the way, we're going to judge angels, but because of our limitation physically, we're under them in that sense. You crown them with glory and honor, us. You put everything under their feet. In putting everything under them, God left nothing that was not subject to them. And he's talking about the physical creation. All right? And not only that, but he's given us the intellectual capacity to understand how the physical world works. And even to manipulate it in ways that are kind of crazy. I talked about that last Saturday. But then we're stewards, right? That word steward, I think, most people in the world don't even know what the word steward means. But, you know, that's kind of a religious word. But it's a pretty good word, actually. Pretty good word. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 2. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 2. It says, now it is required. I'm taking this a little bit of out of context, all right? So please forgive me. I am taking this somewhat out of context. Go ahead and read the context later. So I confess that. But nevertheless, I think this is true in general. It says, but now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. So God has entrusted the earth to us. So we need to be faithful to that thing. And by the way, the Jews got this to a pretty significant extent. The Jews, even the law about, you know, not having cheeseburgers, you know, that whole thing. The Jews got the whole idea of animal cruelty being totally ungodly. Animal cruelty, just wanton use of resources, which I think we just described the United States just in general here. And I'm not going to go off on a rant on environmentalism, Rudy. I'm not going to do that. All right, and it's definitely not in my top five priorities, but I just throw it out there that Christians should be on the side of the environment, just in the broadest sense. Exactly what that means, I'll let that you apply that to yourself. All right, we'll leave it at that. All right, so God entrusted the physical world, plants, animals, fields to us. So it's our job to take care of them, to be husbands to them. That's animal husbandry. That's kind of a weird word, but anyway. And then verse 31. Let's read the end there. By the way, it's not the end of the account. Verse 31, God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. Now, do you agree with that?
Yes.
Do you agree that literally every single thing God created is good?
Yes.
What about the avocado pit?
Make more avocados.
What about parasitical wasps? All right. Well,
they keep their tarantulas in check.
Yes. I would say that there exist things in the physical world that could challenge that assumption.
Yeah.
And in the end, I believe that by faith as well as by my observation. But at some point, you're going to come across something and kind of go, you're going to scratch your head. Really? But God says it's good, and I believe it. And almost everything I know agrees with that. And the ones that don't, I'm just trusting in God in that area. Yes?
Well, I know that some animals and insects adapt to their environment. So do you think that some species, like you said, parasitical wasps, do you think God maybe has not made that, but they evolved?
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. He's asking, so could it be that these parasites exist as a result of evolution? Yes. And I believe that evolution was created by God as part of his plan. And that evolution, which allows things to change to the environment and to adapt to things and allows us to, you know, we have bacteria, so we have, vitamin K and all these things, that there are things that happen in the course of this natural course of change created by God called evolution, causes things to happen that we as human beings might think, that's, you know, why do we have cockroaches? All right? So it's good, I believe, in the big sense, it's good. The thing created is good, all good.
So, John,
yeah.
Couldn't the same thing you said about mutations and things of that nature, the frogs with four legs and all that kind of stuff, that, you know, somehow we've messed up?
I don't know about the fall or maybe. I would just say mutation is good. There's background radiation. It's good. That background radiation causes mutation. Mutation allows change, and that's that thing called evolution. All right. Now, you know, you could debate God's way of doing it in the physical world that he set up. All right. But it seems to work pretty well. In fact, as with all things like the weather, and, you know, plate tectonics, which has sort of seemingly negative implications for us. In the big picture, it's all good. And if somebody could invent a better world than that, I invite them to go ahead and do that. All right. And, of course, they'd have to invent the idea, and they'd have to actually pull it off, all rather difficult things.
But a lot of people would argue that, you know, mental people that are not...
Right. Right.
Those types of things. They would look at that and say, that's not good.
I understand that. And I've sort of obliquely referenced that already. I've already said there are things that exist in this physical world that could cause you to feel a moment of doubt about that. And I even said, I just put it out there, to some extent, I reached this final conclusion on faith. All right? And yet, because, you know, we could list 5,000 things, you know what I'm saying? But, I believe both because I understand how evolution works and because God said so, that a universe which includes mutations is good, et cetera, okay? Michael's next.
Yeah, I was just wondering about the point in time when man fell from sin, you know, and working the land became harder. Right. So, was there a big upheaval in, like...
Okay, we're going to talk about the fall next week a little bit.
I didn't know that.
And that's one of the most difficult questions to answer from the entire Bible, is exactly what is the nature of this fall? That's a theological question, which I don't think you can absolutely 100% delineate what that effect was. But here's the point in Genesis 1:31. At this point, it's all good. And other worldviews disagree with that. Other worldviews say it just is, or it's not all good. But God says it's all good. Okay? By the way, it's all good, right? Should have gone to the next slide. All right? And by the way, We're finishing the creation account. The creation account finishes in chapter 2, verse 3. Why somebody in the Middle Ages had to end at verse 31, I don't know. So let's finish reading the creation account. It says, "And thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Now, is God resting today? No, he's not resting. He's resting from what work? The work of creation. His creation is complete. All right? And so he's not creating new physical laws. The laws of the universe that were in place back then are the laws that are in the universe are in place today. So it's not like God's sitting around twiddling his thumbs waiting for it all to end. But at this point, his interventions are rare. God doesn't just, every time you need the light to turn green, doesn't turn it green for your sake. He doesn't, a car's about to hit you and he just lifts it off the road. God generally is not intervening arbitrarily just for the heck of it. So he's not resting as in sitting around doing nothing, but he's no longer creating in that sense. And I believe his interventions are only purposeful ones and even fairly rare ones, at least in the physical world. All right, I'm reading more into there. That's really, I'll be honest with you, I'm kind of reading into there some stuff that's not really there in that verse. All right, so God rests from creating, but he's not completely resting. And of course, you know that this is the theological justification for the Sabbath. All right, and the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And of course, in Colossians 2, we know that we do not observe the Sabbath. The Sabbath does tell us something, but it doesn't tell us that we have to take a day off from working. In fact, in Hebrews chapter 4, it's quite specific in saying that we do not have a Sabbath. All right? Our Sabbath rest lies in the future. Hebrews 4, 8 through 11. Says God is not going to give them rest. Joshua didn't give them rest until they entered. It says God, they kept moving. Until they're in the promised land, they didn't rest. All right, and he says, and we're not resting until we reach the promised land. So in this life, we're not resting. In the sense of stopping, you know, taking a day off, for example, having a Sabbath. But what I do learn from the Sabbath is that we need to learn to stop working all the time and contemplate God and celebrate God and experience God. So I don't think the Sabbath teaches us nothing, but something that the Jews got from the seventh day. We may not get the exact same thing from that seventh day. All right? So, any questions about that? Yeah. There we go. That's what I'm doing right now. Good timing. So I'm done with studying chapter 1 of Genesis. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to come back in the next 4 minutes and very, very briefly, and I guess I'm going to have to finish it up next Saturday, very, very briefly look at different ways of thinking about these days. So, I mean, as I was hitting the... Oh, I forgot to... Oops. It's too late now. Why bother? But what the heck, you know. Slideshow. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. All right. Right, so let's talk about that. So we're not studying the chapter anymore. We're just talking now. All right. So these are the different views of how to think of it. There's the young earth view. There's really two versions of that. One version of the young earth view, which basically says that these 6 days are six 24-hour periods, and six times 24 is 144, whatever, 144 hours. So 144 hours after he started, he was done. That's the young earth view. There's really two versions of that. One is that the earth is young and that science agrees with that. The other version is that the earth is young because God made it look young. And I'll tell you that this one is just not true. In fact, if the Bible absolutely, definitely said that this is true, that would mean that the Bible is wrong, and that would be a problem. Because the earth does not appear young. You can read all these books by these young earth creationists, and they're a bunch of nonsense and utter shameful things. It's embarrassing that people who call themselves a scientist and try to say that the earth appears young, please take a hike in the Grand Canyon, all right? Or, excuse me, but I was going to say, please take a hike, but that wouldn't be very nice. All right? But, you know, we have stars, we have light reaching the earth from a galaxy a billion light years away. I don't know. It certainly appears to be at least a billion years old. So the earth appears old. I'm sorry. Another view, though, is that the reason it appears old is because God made it appear old. And by the way, when I talk about the age of the earth. I teach at Grossmont College, and I have a lot of fairly conservative Christian background people who are raised with the young earth view, and I tell them, I believe the young earth view is not ridiculous or stupid, honestly. All right? And so I literally do this. I'm going to walk over there and speak from a theological perspective briefly. So I'm leaving my science hat behind. I'm going to walk over here. All right, so let's just say that we believe in an omniscient, omnipotent, all those omni things, God. Could that God create the universe with an appearance of age?
Yeah.
All right. So the only question is whether he did or not. All right, that's good enough for me. And then I walk back over here, and I say, well, what about the fact there's a galaxy which is a billion light years away? So does that galaxy even exist? You know, that's a good question. And then I come back here. Hey, God can do whatever he wants. Who am I to say, you know? Jesus made fish. It was ready to eat, you know? And John the Baptist said, God can make children out of Abraham out of his own, so I believe it. So to me, I mean, I don't agree with the second view. I'll be honest with you. But I find it to be perfectly acceptable. The bottom line is you can't tell from Genesis 1 which it is. And if you can't tell, that must mean that it doesn't matter that much. You know what I'm saying? If God didn't make it clear, then probably it might be because it doesn't matter. That's another view. Another one is the day-age view, which says that this is history. In other words, Genesis saying, first God did this, then God did this, then God did this, then God did this, and then God did this. And it just so happens that if we take that view from a scientific perspective, there are either no conflicts or very few. It's debatable whether there are any or none. That's the day-age theory. Got it? Yes? And then there's the theory that it's 10:45 and we end class on time. That's another theory. But let me just give the names of these things. There's the gap theory, which I believe is discredited by most. There's the framework theory. I'm going to describe both of these as making sense. I don't agree with this one, but, you know, it's awesome. Amen. Awesome for you. I mean, you know, my bias with science may be one reason why I tend to just... All right, this one, got it wrong. Could be. I'm going to describe these two in detail. I lean towards the day-age theory personally. I find the framework theory to be interesting and maybe helpful. And here's the last one. It's just all a bunch of myths. By the way, on... next Saturday, I'm going to tell you that Genesis 1 is a myth. But it's a true myth. And we'll talk about the other creation myths, which are clearly not true. All right, but anyway, see you next Saturday. Buy a book on the way out if you want, and get a muffin.
Thank you, John.
Awesome. 45 minutes and 45 minutes. Within one,
perfect.
Within 30 seconds.
God gave us all the answers.
There you go.
That's true. That's very true.
I think that's part of what's going on, yes.
That's very true. It's part of what's going on.
I think the vaccine explanation is general. It's not a science problem.
Question.
There's not.
I read somewhere like an explanation for lettuce.
For
lettuce,
what?
Lettuce. Now make lettuce. Uh-huh. You know that one part of the Bible. I thought it was the Hebrew word Elohim.